Sometimes life feels out of our control. We get stuck in trauma, old patterns, and change feels out of reach. Sometimes it feels like fate. We want to help you break out of old, unhelpful patterns and become healthier. We're Fate Resilience, taking control of the outcome.
With licensed therapists, Jennifer Oxford,
Taylor Madsen,
Haley Mayer.
Today we're going to be talking about domestic violence. This is specifically physical abuse between romantic partners.
Are we going to add the other types of domestic violence or just physical abuse?
Domestic violence is specifically defined as, there are other kinds of abuse enwrapped in that, but domestic violence is specifically entailed with physical abuse between romantic partners.
Okay, interesting, because what I was reading on it is that it can be physical, sexual, emotional, economic, psychological, and even technological threats, and financial as well. So that's
those will be often entailed, but if it is just financial abuse, that won't be categorized as domestic violence. If there is just emotional abuse, that won't be categorized as domestic violence.
Okay.
If there is physical and or sexual abuse, then that is domestic violence. That is just, and that is enough on its own to be domestic violence, but those other categories on their own is not domestic violence.
Yeah. I think it's good to bring up then, just to be aware that often, you know, as we look at this topic of domestic violence, that this is an area that affects not just the people who are engaged in the behavior, so the one who is abusing and the one who's being abused, but it can affect the children of the situation. If there are children, family members, coworkers, like it can extend into those outer levels of those bigger levels of our community, and it doesn't just affect the couple. So one of the reasons I like to bring up these other things is to be aware of, you know, maybe some signs, hopefully, I don't even know if hopefully is the right word, signs before it gets to physical that can start to be red flags for people.
Well, it does affect the children. I know you said may, and I don't want to harp too much on language.
Oh, yeah.
I'll often work with couples with domestic violence, and the person being the victim of the violence will think that she has somehow contained the violence within the marriage or the relationship, and that the children are somehow unaware or not being affected of it. And I'll ask questions like, do you know what kind of mood he's in based on how he's walking into a room or how he's opening a door or how he's talking on the phone? And every single time when there's domestic violence, the answer is yes. And the children will know what kind of mood dad is in.
Something to be aware of too, I'll just add this now. In the state of Utah, but most states also have the same jurisdiction, but in the state of Utah, the reason why we like to make sure that children, like the part that children have within domestic violence of them being witness of it, the reason why it's important we know that is because within the state of Utah, that would be called secondary trauma or being a witness of it for a child. When it comes to Department of Child and Family Services, that isn't also, it's a reportable thing. So, and being a witness does not just mean seeing the domestic violence that's going on. It can be someone who's hearing the domestic violence going on. It can be someone who has somehow witnessed this account. So that's just something to just be aware of when we're talking about this. It's not just the fact of like children shouldn't be a part of it. It's so big of a thing to have someone in the household of a domestic violence scenario that it is needing to be reported to authorities. If a child is in the home and they, a lot of the times are taken out of the home, if domestic violence, even if it's not perpetrated towards them, if they're witnessing of it. So that's why this is a big issue and something to just be aware of. We won't talk too much about that, but I just wanted to make sure we at least put that in there of an important fact to know about it.
I'd like to say, yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up and added that in, Haley, because I think it's really important for people to realize that the research is far-reaching. I have clients who have gone into adulthood, and because they experienced witnessing domestic violence as a child, that changed their patterns of attachment. It changed their patterns for their own personal relationships later, even if it didn't ever include violence. And so I've seen that you can be a child who witnesses that, and into the later years of life still be experiencing reactionary thoughts, feelings, and emotions based on what you experienced at those early ages, even if you were never the one who was physically harmed.
Or even saw it. I mean, even hearing a thud in the other room, that could be a result of a domestic violence action.
Right.
That is still something that has to be reported, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to note too that if we do use the terms, we talked so much about gender in our last episode, that if we use the he, she terms, know that domestic violence the victim is not always female or male. Sometimes they're non-binary. It can happen in any type of relationship, no matter what the gender. And so while we might say that, we just want to make sure that we know that it is not just men who commit domestic violence.
While it's true that women can be domestically violent and that men can be victims of domestic violence, broad stroke the brush, men are batterers and women are the victims.
Yeah.
It's a myth that both men and women are batterers. It's men are batterers is what research shows, that there's not this silent.
As far as a term of how they abuse, you're not just saying being someone who is the giving end of a domestic relationship, men would have that term about it. Because
yeah, can you define that a little bit too? Because yeah. I don't know.
What research shows is that women, by and large, are not the ones that are domestically violent for two reasons. One is that it's hard to find a woman that is physically capable of domestic violence because of the disparate strengths between men and women. That women aren't large enough and strong enough to batter a man.
Challenge accepted. Just kidding.
Yeah.
So for example, let's talk about the three of us.
Yeah, tell me more.
So we first met at a residential facility and there were bleachers there. We all met when I was already disabled. It's been 8 years now that I've been disabled. Yeah, several years. And so I haven't worked out. I haven't been physically active or anything. But the women on our clinical team weren't capable of lifting those bleachers up on their own. But I still was, despite being disabled for 2 years already at that time. So just the base strength of a man is just greater than a woman.
However, I was able to lift more than them and you. Okay, so it just depends.
Right. No,
but the research of Dr. Jacobson and Dr. Gauman has found, by and large, 30-1, mm-hmm. men are the batterers and not women.
And that's what I want to point out is the percentage is so high that we do use that term, and it's not inappropriate to talk about it in that way. That there are outliers in every situation.
Yeah, and so in their research, mm-hmm. specifically around domestic violence, because I know that this is a very hot topic,
mm-hmm.
And like in our last episode, I'm very into gender equality. And
I'm not laughing at Taylor. Yeah. I'm just like, yes, that makes sense.
And that when women are violent in relationships, it is almost exclusively in self-defense when men are violent.
I'd also say there's a lot, something to just state, because I could also see, I have a lot of clients, I have a few clients who are men who've gone through a domestic violence. There are so many different things, because what we talked about last time too is not just the physical strength of an individual and things like that. It's also the idea of like so many things of like, how was that person socialized? How are men socialized versus women? It can also be a lot to do with, you know, with women, there's an obvious stopping point that they're taught more often of what is appropriate and what is not with physical versus men. So there's so many things within it. So we're painting with a really broad brush. So we understand there's a lot of different little things that make up that research. Something to be aware of that, at least I was taught in grad school, all of the stats with physical violence, domestic abuse, things like that. Unfortunately, men are underreporters. And so something to be aware of is when you look at stats, from my experience and my thing is that you have less situations where the male part of a relationship, even if it's a double male relationship, men are less likely to report.
And Jacobson and Gottman get into the underreporting of men.
Yeah.
And that it's largely a myth that men are underreporting their violence.
Really?
What research?
This was around the time that you were in grad school.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
I think it's
I mean, it's in
good.
my office. You're welcome to read it.
I think it's really good for us to just check in. Sometimes we do have biases and we have thoughts, and to go back to the research and say what's being said. And then to take a step back, because as therapists, like, it's good to know all of this, and then we're dealing with whoever's in front of us, right? So when we have experienced working with people who've been in domestic violence situations, and sometimes we have seen the outliers, that would obviously make us want to make sure that nobody's left out. When we're saying everybody, my personal belief is everyone deserves to be safe and feel safe in their relationships. That would be a value that I
Right, not
have.
saying that men aren't victims of domestic violence, just going through myths.
Yeah, I wondered if they talked a little bit about the difference in same gender relationships. Did they go into that at all, Taylor?
It's mostly men against women
Okay, interesting.
because of the power dynamics.
Yeah.
Men don't tend to batter people that are on the same power level as them. And so we don't see the same amount of interpersonal violence in same-sex relationships.
Okay, interesting. And I think it's, like I said, I think it's good to ground us in research. We talked previously about we've talked previously about physical abuse, so this of course applies into the domestic relationship. One of the things that I think it's interesting to realize is that where do I want to go? What I was,
Well, let's
I,
go. You just talked about physical abuse. Last
yeah.
time we talked about how it's intentional. That's another thing about domestic violence, is that the physical and sexual abuse is intentional, that they are doing it on purpose, that they are capable of controlling their anger. There is this myth that domestic violence happens because of an anger problem. Not saying that their anger isn't an issue, but the violence isn't because their anger is uncontrollable. And you will see this because batterers will control their anger when the police are around or when another man is bigger is around them. They will only act out when someone that they perceive as weaker than them is around.
Let Or me. somebody who could hold them accountable, because I think sometimes you'll see even where they'll act out at home, but maybe at their job, even if they're not with other males, although they would probably gear towards jobs or with other males, but that they would do image management around that so that other people wouldn't know. So that what you're saying is if they can manage their anger around other people, then if you're
They're
not
capable
managing.
of managing it at home. Absolutely.
So there's no, we can't use that excuse of I deserved it, and we can't use that excuse of I made him mad. No, he chose to be mad to the level that he allowed himself permission to cross physical boundaries and harm another person. And if he was not capable of controlling his anger, you would probably see him have legal issues and those kinds of things.
One thing I would add, say too is so domestic violence is one term, interpartner violence, or sorry, intimate partner violence is another term you'll hear.
We're going to use them interchange. I've been
Yeah.
using them interchangeably right now, I
Yeah.
should say.
And with intimate partner violence, that includes this physical aspect. I just want to point out too, real quick, like we're talking about the physical. Like you were saying, Jen, like physical violence, sexual violence, stalking, psychological aggression, like those four things go under intimate partner violence. So just to be aware, we're just talking about one aspect of it. So it's like this weird kind of umbrella where it's like domestic violence covers a lot of different things. Intimate partner violence also covers a lot of different things. We're specifically talking more about that physical aggression within the relationship, not so much about the stalking psychological aggression.
I'd like to get into that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be
Because
clear
then
that
that's
if
mentioned.
someone
Yeah.
is only stalking, if stalking is a really big deal, if they're only stalking, that isn't domestic violence.
It's intimate partner violence, which is.
Right. So it's kind of that idea of like something's all fruit, but only apples are apples. Right.
Yes.
So if you have an orange, we're not going to call it all fruit. We're going to say these are oranges. So it's about labeling and understanding it doesn't all fall under the umbrella. So if you do experience stalking, you haven't also experienced the same thing as domestic violence to that physical, intimate partner level. That does not mean you did not go through abuse. It just means it wasn't labeled under domestic violence.
And because of their ability to control their anger, therapy is ineffective for batterers.
That's something, that's a reason why us as therapists, if we hear of that, it's a well-known thing ethically. We can't, it's not that we can't engage in therapy, but there are people out there who have specific training to engage in therapy with batterers.
I'm one of them.
Yeah. And I've done a lot of the training as well. I personally don't go out of my way to garner that population of clients often, just because also just for me setting wise, I work with a lot of vulnerable populations. And so to me, I try to keep the environment a safe space for those who've experienced vulnerable things like that. But yeah, those people who've had that experience, there's a reason we blatantly as therapists say, if someone's within a relationship as a couple partnership or the couple therapy setting, we do not do couples therapy with batterers at all. And all therapists
with training, there are circumstances that you can. There has to be 6 months since the most recent violent incident. And there has to be a contract that there will be no more violent incidents. And if there are, you will discontinue couples therapy.
And that's, again, with training. That's not done just because the therapist is like, well, I think we can give it a go, right? Like that's, again, the difference between licensing with it and not being licensed with that and credentialing.
Yeah, a court order can say they need couples therapy, but if it hasn't been 6 months and you're not trained in it, it's still a no-go. And so what's best for batterers to rehabilitate isn't therapy, it's actually prison. It is best to treat them as a criminal and not as someone with mental health problems.
You say that, and I completely agree. I think where people struggle is that when that does not mean they don't have mental health problems. That does not mean they didn't have trauma. It just means that the treatment, when we've gone to crossing that level of boundary of attacking somebody who is an attachment figure in our life, it's just a different approach.
Jacobson and Gottman struggle with their own conclusions from their research as well, and the findings is that most batterers witnessed battering growing up between their parents, and that addressing the trauma or working on anger management techniques, which, as we discussed earlier, isn't the root of the issue, isn't effective. The only thing that is effective, consequences from the court, and prison is the most effective. And so it's very counterintuitive.
And it's interesting because this goes back to that idea of image management, that they can control it. And when we do, when things are known and they're held accountable from the social standard, right, then that actually will do better. So the secrecy behind domestic violence actually doesn't help anyone, right? So when we say, oh, this happened and we should keep it a secret, or those kinds of things, or no one deserves to know, the secrecy isn't helping anybody.
There are two kinds of batterers. The first kind is a cobra. Cobras, the secrecy won't matter to them. Their heart rate doesn't even increase when they're hitting someone. They batter people merely because they're in proximity to them. And so you may be in a relationship with them. You may be in a romantic relationship with them. You may be married to them. And they're beating you merely because you're in the same room, the same house as them, and they don't care. And in fact, they think very little of you for staying despite beating you. Pit bull, and they're called cobras because they strike just like a cobra does because someone is close by. Now, they don't care if people know. They don't care if people don't know. They just don't care. They just strike because someone's nearby. It's very impersonal. The second kind is a pit bull, and they're called pit bulls because, like the dog, sometimes the dog gets lockjaw and they bite and they can't let go, despite maybe even wanting to. The pit bull is very much caught up in secrecy and fear of abandonment. These are the ones that start with love bombing has kind of come into popular culture's awareness recently, that they'll do grand displays of love early on in the relationship. They will appear to be vulnerable. They will share really dark things, and it'll seem like, wow, they're sharing these things with me while withholding other things.
They'll also like kind of love bombing along with gaslighting of like, you're the only one who understands this. Like they'll put you in a perceived position of power of being the person who's understanding.
Perceived is the important part of that.
But really they're the one holding the strings underneath that.
And they will, go ahead, Jen.
Well, I was going to say, and that perceived position of power is about, you are now responsible for me emotionally, right? Yes. And that's their goal. So they might be very, what's the word? They might be very flattering and say, oh, you're so wonderful. I really appreciate you.
Like faux humility,
but also just a lot of like, if other people have been dismissed or disregarded, they might say, oh, this is really great that he's so complimentary of me. But when the compliments go into, now you're emotionally responsible for me, that's where we're moving into, you know, that codependence that we've previously talked about that's unhealthy and exists in all of these.
Now a pit bull, go ahead, John. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, I was just going to say it exists in all these relationships, but I think it's just important to recognize that the niceness is about control. It's not about love and compassion and empathy. It's about controlling the person.
Yeah, they will begin to isolate their victim, the person that they're in a relationship with. Pretty soon you're not being with friends that you used to be around. You're not being with family that used to be around.
Which it's not always perceived as I'm keeping you away from them. It's often perceived as they just don't understand you as well as we do. So it doesn't have to, within that even, like we're talking about pit bull and cobra and the two opposites, even within the pit bull format, it's something to be understanding of, like, it isn't always seen as like, you can't talk to them. It's often like, you know, it's a shame that they're not understanding you and they're really awful to you when they're not, to try to pull you away from it.
Yeah. And sometimes it will be framed as the other people are distancing themselves. And sometimes the people will distance themselves on their own because they can't handle. Yeah, it's uncomfortable. They can't tolerate seeing that dynamic anymore. And so pretty soon you'll be around. You'll have few friends and you'll have few family that support you. And maybe the porch light is left on for you, as it were, metaphorically, but eventually it will just be you and the batterer and maybe anyone that the batterer chooses. And then financially, you'll be completely dependent on the batterer. Even if the batterer doesn't have a job and you're the one working, the batterer completely makes all the financial decisions. Everything is in the batterer's name. And the batterer has all of the passwords and logins for the financial institutions. And this is where those other things that you were mentioning, Jen, come into play. The stalking, the financial abuse, they will show up at workplaces. They will show up at friends gatherings because of that fear of abandonment that they have. They will do anything to ensure that you aren't doing anything without their say-so, without their knowing. And if you do anything without their approval, then they will show up and they will cause a scene.
And this goes into some of the emotional abuse red flags that you can see, where they're undermining your sense of self-worth. They're calling names. They're saying, it's your fault that I feel this way. It's your fault I feel unsafe. It's your fault I feel like you're cheating. And so there's a lot of blame going on and a lot of criticism. So criticism and diminishing somebody's worth is a big part of how they try and justify their need to control other people.
Broad stroke of the brush, there's no danger really in leaving a cobra, because again, they're dangerous just because you're in their proximity. Leaving a pit bull, it's more dangerous. Leaving a pit bull up to 2 years after is more dangerous than actually when you're with the pit bull. And so sometimes we give good intention advice to people in our lives of, why don't you just leave them? You deserve better, things like that. And it actually might put the person in more danger. And it certainly doesn't actually encourage people to leave. It creates shame in the victim. And shame has us feel stuck. And we talked about shame for a couple episodes. And that doesn't move people to leave. And so being there for them, offering them, hey, if you ever need to come and stay with me, I'm here for you. Is there anything I can do? Being empathetic with them. But encouraging people to leave a pit bull is actually much more dangerous than them staying. What we do see helps people leaving is when the sadness and the fear they feel with their husband, or their boyfriend, their partner, turns to contempt. And women that fight back are more likely to leave their partner than women that do not, which is very interesting. And again, it's not good advice to tell someone that they should hit back, because maybe the husband's violence might increase, it might become deadly. Women are more likely in the United States to be killed by their partner than by a stranger.
Yeah, it's a pretty huge stat that they often push with it. I think it intimate violence that happens, they talk about like it's 15% of all violent crimes and things like that, and it's because it's happening within like the intimate, right? Like between two people who are in a relationship. But something to also just plug into is that when it comes to this intimate partner violence as well, is that there are certain, like we talked about women being a more vulnerable population with it. There are certain like cultures where that is also a lot higher, like indigenous women and things like that, that statistically like the rate goes up a whole amount when you're in certain types of things. So just to be aware when it comes to like more likely to be harmed or, you know, even potentially, you know, killed in the situation, like those kinds of things add to that statistic going up even more with those even more vulnerable populations.
Yeah, what we find is most helpful to help someone exit a domestically violent relationship is to letting them know that they don't have to leave now, to provide resources and to let them know, like, hey, if you need a year, you need 5 years to get out of this, to do that and to come up with a safety plan. So if they need to go Tuesday night, then, hey, where do I go? I'm going to Haley's house. Okay, if Haley's not home, where are we going? I'm going to Jen's house. And then you have a go bag packed, and maybe you have some cash hidden. Some people, even if they're the one working, their partner isn't, are given just enough cash for groceries, and they start saving the change that they get at the grocery store because they found a sale that their partner wasn't aware of. And they just start saving that change so that they can escape one day.
It's also important when you're talking to someone about it, you in no way, as much as you're not telling them they should leave, you do not have to condone anything that's happening, right? That's an important differentiation to be making. Like, you do not need to say, oh, it's not too big of a deal because you're like, well, they can't leave anyways, right? You can still continue to say, like, I don't like that that happens to you. Let me know how I can be there for you, right? Like Taylor said, like the porch light on kind of thing. Some families, they put that boundary up because they look and it's hard to see their family member being in that situation. But that whole idea of like, but we're here for you whenever you're ready for it, you can take that. But when you're talking to a friend or someone who's talking to you through about this domestic violence scenario, you in no way, just because they're not ready to leave yet, have to make it better for them. Okay. You can be supportive, but still not have to go into trying to make it a better scenario mentally for them.
So a couple things with that, especially as you're supporting somebody, maybe you're going through it yourself or you've got somebody who else is going through it. One thing is to remember that it doesn't help to talk bad about the batter for long periods of time because they actually will start to feel like they need to defend him and why they're staying. And so it might put them into shame, like Taylor was saying. And so be very cautious that it can be hard to listen to that, but it also can be something where you don't have to say a lot. Sometimes they need to be able to vent in a healthy way and they need to see that somebody else agrees it's wrong. But going into, oh, I hate that guy and he's so terrible, might actually put them on the place where they feel like they have to defend their batter. So just be a little bit cautious about how deeply you go into that. And then one more thing that I will say is that there's a lot of free resources for domestic violence, and there's a lot of advocates out there. And so, whenever I've had somebody who's in a situation for domestic violence, I've always had them align with an advocate in the community, from one of the resources. And they do a really good job of helping with that safety planning that Taylor just touched on, because there's so much more that we could go into. And they also can help you ground into what's real and what's healthy and what's not. Sometimes, as you're working through what to do, people can escalate. escalate, and you need to know what behavior looks like an escalation. If this is being said to me, do I really need to be worried about it? Because there can be lots of threats, like if you leave financially or other things might happen. And so working with those advocates I've seen for those people that I've counseled with has been really good for them. And they'll say, you know, I contacted my domestic violence advocate and they helped me through some of the legal stuff if it got to a legal point, or they helped me through a safety planning situation. And I just really want to support. There's a lot of good work being done out there by domestic violence advocates.
There's actually an advocate hotline when it comes to that. And so there are things to be aware of like Jen was saying, like there's an overall one that is national where it's 24/7. And that number, we'll put it with the podcast, but it's the 1-800-799-7233 number, which is great because they also offer it through many different languages. So if you know of someone who has that need and you don't know how to necessarily help them because of language barriers, that's also some great resources. Because unfortunately, that is a huge thing that when we're talking about vulnerable populations, a lot of people, especially in the United States, they can't get resources and they're scared to get resources because they've been alienated because of language, because of a lot of different things. And so knowing that there are resources available to help you in those more vulnerable areas or vulnerable populations is really helpful as well to be able to offer.
I know we've talked about mandated reporting in each of the last podcasts, I think, covering trauma.
So like in all of them, but
yeah. We've talked about what happens. I don't want to spend much time on this, but when a report has been made, I've seen that be the most positive thing that's happened in a client's life, because it's been a wake-up call. And while it's been scary for them,
for both sides too, but absolutely. You're referring to right now the one who's being battered.
To the one being battered, to the batterer, in the previous episodes, when children, in this one as well, when children are witnessing it, when there's emotional abuse, when there's neglect. To have outside resources come in, or even if DCFS doesn't step in, and have them realize, I didn't realize that I crossed the line that far, that behavior changes really quickly. And it's quite the wake-up call. Mm-hmm. And so if you're that person watching someone and you know something is happening, or if you're in that place yourself and you don't know what to do, calling without giving your information and just saying, hey, I have this friend.
It's a hypothetical situation. Yeah. That's what I would do. Yeah.
And just ask what they might would do just to see if you'd feel comfortable making the report. And just knowing sometimes what might happen can help you feel empowered. That number that Haley just gave is an excellent resource. There are things that can be done.
And I think this goes back to what you said earlier, Taylor, where when we bring in social expectations and consequences, we're going to see more improvement for the lives of people who are involved and less. And, you know, that's what the research is showing us. So give yourself permission to speak up if you need to speak up, and make sure that you're using the resources that we have in society to help these populations so that they can heal.
Yeah.
And I think it's also just important to know too, like, if you're hearing this and you're not ready to look at these kinds of things, that's totally fine. That's okay. Like we were just saying, put it on pause. That's okay. So just follow your gut with that so that you can kind of go into that journey that we're talking about with it.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. And if you want to find us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Fate Resilience. We'd love to hear from you.